First of all, small disclaimer, I'm not a programmer, I'm not a security specialist, I don't got root, nor should I have root, and I'll show you a couple of reasons why I probably shouldn't, and I'll show you how I teach other students to know just enough about computers to be dangerous and annoy people like you, and most of what I'm going to talk about is working with industrial design students at the Rhode Island School of Design and also engineering students at Brown University. Teach courses for 6 years now between those two departments, and a lot of what we do is designing human-computer interaction or human-computer interfaces, and I'm going to take you through just a brief tour of the last couple of years of us trying to build better toolkits for designers and engineers to collaborate and create higher fidelity models, both in sketching early on in the development process and then later on in prototyping, so they can really articulate their concepts to themselves and also to manufacturing and so on. So I'm going to start off with kind of a classic video that's one of my favorites here to set up the field.
And talk to you about the control techniques. Control devices, control dialogue.
I'm going to just turn down my audio because I think I'm the only control for that, so sorry for that.
And control meta language that we're using. Okay, to talk about control devices, we'll use this overhead camera shot where you can see the devices that I'm using. I use three, and they're not all standard. We have a pointing device called a mouse, a standard keyboard, and a special key set we have here. And we're going to go for a picture down in our laboratory in Menlo Park and pipe it up. That'll show you, from another point of view, more about how that mouse works. Come in, Menlo Park. Okay, there's Don Andrews' hand in Menlo Park. And in a second, we'll see the screen that he's working and the way the tracking spot moves in conjunction with movements of that mouse. I don't know why we call it a mouse. Sometimes I apologize. It started that way, and we never did change it. All right. As it moves up or down or sideways, so does the tracking spot. And the principles for its operation are quite easy to see. You'll turn it over, Don. Can you hear me, Don? We'll just turn it over, and we'll see. Right. Its principle is that there are two wheels that roll on the surface. But since they're right angles and kind of sharp edges, one roll and the other slide in one direction. Each of these wheels controls through a potentiometer with a voltage output sampled by an AD converter. The numbers taken in by the computer at sample times as to what the horizontal vertical components are to be of where it should put the tracking spot. And as the mouse moves over a surface, then each of those wheels either slides sideways without rolling or rolls an amount that very closely duplicates the particular component of horizontal or vertical in the net motion it makes. Alright, if you take a mouse and move it through some closed trajectory back to exactly the same point, usually the tracking spot won't come back to exactly the same place it was on the screen. And for that sense, it wouldn't work well if you're trying to trace maps or other figures and diagrams. But the way we use it continuously and exclusively is to watch the screen and to follow it around, and we use this merely as a device to move that tracking spot, and you're eyeing the tracking spot, you really don't care whether it follows exactly this or not. In fact, we've had it at times where our tracking device, you had to move in an arc like that to make the tracking spot go on a horizontal line, and people adjusted to it and would go like that to go in a straight line and wouldn't even know that they were doing it.
Stop that right there. Many of you have probably already seen this video. I don't know. This is classic, of course. Douglas Engelbart in 1968, SRI, Stanford Research, working also with people at Xerox PARC. And there's 100 innovations that happen in this video series, from copy, cut, and paste to the mouse to the QWERTY keyboard. But I think some of the more important things that happen here is things that they learned after they were able to start testing. They were able to mock up a mouse. I'm sure it took some engineers. And once they did, they thought that people were going to want to be able to trace things exactly. And they realized that it didn't have very good tolerances for doing that. But then they noticed that people were able to adapt it and actually be able to lift up the mouse, put it down again, things that they didn't think people were actually capable of doing. And so I'm going to show you a lot of examples of how we've developed product concepts through hands-on building and testing, and some of the toolkits we've used to be able to do that better. So to start off with a typical example of what happens in industrial design schools, is anyone here an industrial designer? No? Okay, so this is going to seem a little off the topic. This isn't about, you know, hacking Bluetooth or anything, but we'll get to some more computer stuff in a minute, I promise. So here's a chair made out of steel and leather and bent wood, which I made, and it took a good year. And the point is that in order to make this chair structural and to make it, the curves of it, of course, have influences on its cultural aspects and things like that, I had to know a lot about steel, a lot about how it behaved using the tools, and I couldn't just imagine that by drawing it on paper. By slip rolling steel, it became harder. There were certain things I could do to create the curves to make it more rigid. And I'm proposing that industrial designers working with the media of analog and digital conversion and scripting and these kind of elements of interaction need to be able to develop these same sensitivities to some degree. And so I'm trying to define that threshold and enable that. So before that chair was possible, there were hundreds of these quarter-scale models. One of the most important things about working at this scale is that you can take trash materials. It's not about being cheap. I mean, the tuition is $35,000 a year or something. It's about being fearless, being able to work very quickly and be able to rapidly iterate an idea, testing it, comparing several of them together. This is something that is traditionally impossible for an industrial designer to do with a really interactive system that doesn't just use a QWERTY keyboard and a web page. Then, even in full scale, using cheap materials again, the things that'll happen to this model, even though it's made out of plywood and sheetrock screws, is going to happen in the steel model. Like, when I sit on it, the weak spots are going to tell me a lot about where my weld stresses are going to be and things like that. So, I'm going to try to make an analogy to this process. Then, after all of that's done, it's time to move to CAD and really quantify it so that it can be CNC bent and welded and so on. Now, take another project, a remote control for a television project that we give to sophomores in college. This is probably one of the lowest level interactive products out there. I mean, it's been around for a long time. We can buy universal ones for $10. But what industrial designers are told, and these are the people that design your products for the most part, how many people here have at least one gripe with some piece of electronic interface in their life, whether it be a microwave oven or a handheld or a laptop? This is our fault, or the fault of the people who organize how we fit into the larger workflow of manufacturing from marketing to mass production. And exactly. So what are we given when we're given a problem in industrial design school? And this is a fancy industrial design school, right? I mean, it's been around for a couple hundred years or so. And so we're told we have certain components inside, and here are their dimensions. You're going to have a board. It's going to be 2 inches by 1.5 inches by, you know, 5/8 of an inch thick. It's going to have a 9-volt battery. You're going to have to design little living hinge snap-in enclosures to hold the battery in place, and maybe some foam will keep it from vibrating and whatever. But we have no way of knowing anything about the electronics. In this level, that's not such a bad thing. I don't need to know how to pick one resistor from another in order to figure out what's going to feel best in the hand and allow for the ergonomics for you to be able to reach the buttons you need to intuitively. But so you see these kind of feeble drawings of an industrial designer trying to figure out, well, the battery will fit here. They don't know anything about how heat's going to affect it. What they're really concerning themselves with is the overall form. So we know a lot about human physiology, and we know a lot about manufacture. And so we're thinking about parting lines of plastic, but we're missing one very fundamental part of the design constraint, and that's the behavior of the system. So in the chair example, there's form and content. Content is, it's a chair. This is the form of this chair as opposed to these chairs. It talks to us in our vernacular of, I sit in it this way. I don't lay it on its side and try to figure out how to sit on it. But with something that's an interactive system, we've moved beyond just having form and content. Now these systems actually have behavior. It's part of, we engage in a reciprocal action process when we interact with the system. It's going to have character. It's going to show, we're going to have a visibility of certain affordances to us. It's going to tell us what it can do, how we should go about doing it, and we'll know when we've done it properly. But the people who are designing these objects that you're going out and buying and are being mass manufactured have never tested that. They put the screen there. They know you can reach all the buttons, but they don't know what happens when you need to press delete 5 times and move up to the screen. They can map that on paper. Paper prototyping is kind of a hot topic in our field. But to really test it, we'd need engineers and computer scientists to start making, you know, flashing chips and making us small embedded systems, or we'd use PIC processing or PIC programming, just kind of a traditional way of doing it. But even PIC programming for an industrial designer is not necessary. So we've come up with another solution. This is a old drawing lent to me by a good friend, Bill Buxton. It's a drawing by John Conti, and it describes another process, a traditional process of designers doing this kind of testing and development. Say this is a speech recognition program. The person on the left-hand side talks into the microphone, goes through, comes out on the other side of a wall to a speaker. The person types into the screen what they said real fast. The person on the other side thinks it's magic. It's called the Wizard of Oz effect. And this was one of the best ways for us to actually test our designs until we had some more flexible toolkits. It's this kind of simulation. Ignore the fact that this is a desktop computer and imagine the thing you're holding in your hand acts like this flash animation. And so here are some of the core questions that we're asking ourselves. And when I say we, I mean a co-teacher of mine and I, Nick Scapatici. How can an HCI studio balance an exploration of technology with a commitment to human-centered design? So especially at our school, where we're very much focused on humanitarian, human-centered products as opposed to, you know, some other schools that really focus on transportation and toys and things like that. And so that was important for us. How can industrial designers extend their knowledge of engineering without encroaching on the work of engineers? So we're not trying to just make, you know, cliff notes for engineering for designers, but how do we build a bridging vocabulary so that not only can industrial designers access some of what engineers can do, but vice versa, they can communicate with each other. And if any of you have ever worked in a product development program, it'll go from kind of corporate goals, we need to sell more of these. Marketing says this is what people want. Designers say this is maybe what it should do, what it should look like, how it should feel. Engineers take it and say this is how the plastic parts should be made, and then it goes off to manufacture. By the time that model goes from a concept, an idea that's usually marker renderings and some shaped foam, to a working prototype, there's such an investment in this product that it's very difficult to really take significant steps back and reiterate a design. It becomes very expensive, and so we're trying to, again, with this tool set, alleviate some of that pressure. How can the studio create an environment in which students can use computer hardware and software as sketch materials? Just to clarify one more time, the idea of sketch versus prototype, sketching is something that happens very early on in the development process. After you've gotten a brief, you diverge. Could be this, it could be that, and you try to just brainstorm as broadly as you can, as opposed to prototyping is where we're really entering the funnel and we're trying to converge on a particular idea and its details. Okay. And then how can the course itself be approached as a design problem, which was for me. And so one of the first things we did, maybe some of you have done this before, was, and maybe I'll try out using this term, we hacked keyboards. We found that we had a whole stack of these old SGI keyboards after all of our O2s were put in their final resting place. And we took them apart, and of course they have small microcontrollers inside. And the older and crappier the keyboard is, the more easy it is for an industrial designer or anyone else, a hobbyist or whoever, to solder wires onto the leads that would normally go to the keys. And what that lets you do, example of one here so you can get an idea of the size. This is out of one of those SGI keyboards. I soldered a small set of terminal blocks to the top of it so you could screw wires down to it and reuse it. But it allows you to have some 30-something keystrokes move in and out or just into the computer. So then what we did was now I can touch any two pieces of wire together and they'll press the letter A into the computer. I can write a simple script in something as accessible as Flash that says, if the letter A is pressed, start this video clip or advance the interface or query this database or whatever it is and build a higher fidelity prototype. So I'll show you some of those sketches. One of the first projects that we do before we even start using computers at all is called What is a Switch? And so we're really just thinking about how do you capture a human gesture to connect two wires to each other so then we can work with the actual hardware afterwards. So this is pretty fun stuff.
Like, wait, if it was buttons.
This audio is not really edited, so I'll talk through it a little bit. So there's all these scraps. They start off, they have to come back with 50 sketches in 1 week, and so they'll go to the metal shops and plastic shops and wood shops and textiles and fashion and find some inspiring materials. Sometimes it comes from finding a form that already exists as a cutoff from some other project, or sometimes it's just finding these cheap raw materials to sketch with. But you can really see the progression in 1 week from their first sketches to their last sketches, how they're really starting to think more about the behavior of materials. Just let you watch some of this. So just every way that you could think of that humans could touch something, breathe on something, even faking analog sensors by just having multiple contacts. But again, we're not asking them to even hook up batteries and light bulbs. It's just, I found a piece of perforated steel and a piece of wire. What if each of these holes was a connection? And, you know, I just used the natural flexibility of the wire. And it's pretty amazing some of the things that they invent without knowing it. I mean, there's some things here that look an awful lot like the way data is stored on drives, and they're making them out of fabric and pins. And so I'd argue that in a computer science class or traditionally an HCI course at a university, which would traditionally be inside of an engineering department, that this kind of hands-on exploration, even pre-computers, isn't happening as much as it should be, at least from the places I've visited. We're really trying to encourage that. These are sophomores and juniors in an undergraduate program in industrial design. They've already had 2 years of wood and metal and plastic shops experience, so after they're done with this, they're able to go out and build fantastic stuff, but we're able to make them work now. Some students go out on their own and decide to get really crazy and hook up some batteries and LEDs. So incredibly lo-fi compared to everything else here at the conference, but an incredible amount of creativity happening in 1 week around just a simple concept. And one of the last things we do is try to put them into groups and try to understand how can we start to categorize the behaviors of these things. What is it about the materials that you chose that make them good for interfaces or give them a particular behavior, character. So then I'll show one more quick video that gets a little bit further into that. If I hadn't just shut it. Hang on a second. So then once we add the keyboard hacking to it, we're just with the designers was where we started. We just used Flash. We're able to write very simple scripts. We had a lot of constraints, like the school, even though it has this incredible tuition, only gives a studio for one semester a $300 budget for materials, and the rest has to come out of students' pockets. And so we couldn't buy $800 licenses for a Max MSP jitter or whatever to run on these machines. We had to do with what we had. And so Flash was actually really good because the students had already learned it a little bit. do some animated visualizations of projects. It was already installed. It had a graphical authoring environment where these students were very used to drawing their ideas. They could draw there. They could animate there. They could import video clips, audio clips, and control them all through these models with hacked keyboards. And just after we started this, the word got out, and we had to start turning away keyboards and mice and game controllers. Of course, every secretary on campus was dropping off milk crates full of old hardware. So it really turned out to be a rich resource for us. And some of them, we got more into projects and we started thinking about how could you use this. And so this girl made a book to teach children about, in this case, not scratching their bug bites. But she was able to just take two pieces of tin-plated steel, hot glue them into a notebook that she bought at the bookstore, and with a hack keyboard make this really interactive book in 2 days so that she could build it 10 more times within the 12-week semester. Very lo-fi, but she was able to actually test it with people. This is also something that classically happens when you start encouraging students to bring their laptops into the workshops. So water makes the plant on the web grow, and because some of these students knew how to write some basic PHP and stuff, we were able to have these flash sites actually be on the web. And, I'd warned them. So, getting back here a little bit, hacking the keyboard, just if any one of you haven't done it before, I don't want to be proclaiming this as my invention or something. I actually first learned it when I was doing an artist in residency in Switzerland, but it's been going on forever. There are websites, people, you know, building their own arcade games and stuff like that with this, and of course you can use any programming language. For us, it was just a cheap, available resource that we could start getting input into the computer. Some of the next steps we took was, of course, just putting buses on them, and then this was a wireless USB mouse keyboard, so we could have all these inputs inside of a foam model and have it be wireless to the computer, and again, it's like $25 or something. Since we've hacked rumble packs and everything else that go in both directions, but we also built our own software. So just a summary of what was happening there. You have switches just connecting two pieces of metal, keyboard controller. Of course, you don't need any drivers. Even PS2 jacks disappearing. You can get a USB adapter. Incredibly forgiving medium. That was one of the core things about it. So I'll skip through a couple of these slides, come back, or I'll just talk about them quickly. Some of the assignments, we're still not talking about computers. The point wasn't to teach courses about computers. We're teaching courses about the way humans want to use computers and what they want to do with them, how they do it. And so we were always still focusing on the human needs, not on trying to make a better technology. And in this case, a student spent a semester exploring a navigational system for the vision impaired in grocery stores. 5 times later, I can answer questions about some of these projects. This one was a set of interactive children's books for people living in the salt mining community in India. Tried to have the students talk about cultures that they knew that they could actually research, and she was able to go home and really test with these people. And this girl made a very interesting set of like $2 Geiger counter plastic jewelry for children to help them to avoid depleted uranium bombs in war-torn areas. And so here's some of the components of our problem now. We knew that getting just keyboard, you know, letter presses into the computer was just a start. It was getting us only binary on and offs, and it was only in one direction. It was only going in. We had this dream of we're going to control every electrical appliance. We're going to use every kind of industrial sensor out there. And granted, there were ways to do this. We could program. We could use PIC processors. We could buy very expensive hardware like iCubex by Infusion Systems or something like this. And then programs like MaxMSP or even using some just Java or something, we could have built these systems. But we wanted, our goal was to make it transparent to designers, like a pencil. They draw, they don't focus on the pencil the whole time. And so what we did was we found a bunch of sensors that we're interested in, from motion sensing, regular switches, light, heat, force, flex, proximity, rotary encoders or potentiometers, accelerometers, things that we thought would be really exciting elements to our palette in designing. And on the other end, we had actuators. We wanted to be able to control stepper motors, regular DC motors, nitinol valves, any kinds of servos, do some remote control stuff if we could, LEDs and so on. And in the middle, ideally what we would like to do is have that be able to be networked, so I could be here with you and touching some interface, and the motion of people in this room is driving, you know, stepper motors in China or something. We want to, could this be possible to do really easily? Could we mock something like that up in a few hours? And the answer is yes, we are able to do that now, and I'll show you how. And so, lots of these hardware toolkits started popping up a few years ago. This one is called the Telio Network by a company called Making Things out in San Francisco, and we've since worked with them pretty extensively. Another very popular one that you see at a lot of conferences is called Fidgets. I can answer any questions about these later. But every kind of analog input, motor controller output, servo controllers, they prepackage sensors with all their hardware, but with something like Fidgets, only works on Windows, have to use Visual Basic to control it. With Telio, they were asking people either to use C or to use MaxMSP, which is a $600 digital signal processing program. So it's still prohibitive. The hardware is all there. It's $100 for these modules, but designers still can't use it, and engineers don't need to. So we're still working towards this bridging vocabulary here. So now what we wanted was to have sensors and switches and electrical appliances connect to these hardware widgets, hardware modules, then be controlled by a server, that this router that we were going to create, and that would be able to allow communications to happen over a network and communicate with Flash movies. And it's just one step away from the keyboard, but now we have bidirectional control. And so this is what we did. We created a piece of software called Nada. And what it does is we didn't want Java programmers or other programmers to think, to become very snobby about this right away and think, oh, this is just a Flash authoring environment for hardware widgets. This is just, you know, a wimpy tool. So we knew we needed to get buy-in from both audiences in order to really make it a collaborative platform. And so what we did was we created a complete Java API as well as an ActionScript API. So now my engineering students and computer science students and industrial design students are collaborating on single projects together using the tool of their choice. So what's happening here, it's a little hard to read this slide. We decided also that we didn't want to serve just one type of hardware. We wanted to be open cross-platform as far as the kind of hardware widgets. So Telio, Fidgets, but what was really important to us is looking at the way MIDI developed as a model and the way Yamaha and Korg and Roland and all these people had different keyboards, but it took MIDI to really make a common platform for communications. We decided to support all MIDI hardware as well. So you can tear the controllers out of old synthesizers, and those are analog to digital converters because of velocity in your key presses. So for pennies at a flea market, now you can control, you can have all of this analog input. So any kind of MIDI hardware and any hardware platform that we think is viable or that people are bringing to our attention, we've been supporting. So these little connectors here are called extensions, and this is the part that we're opening to the developer community. So you have a piece of hardware that you'd like to be able to interact with the NADA router. These extensions have, there's an extensions API, so you'd be able to write that. You can also use Java, like I said, and that's all documented in Java docs as a full API. And then on this side, you have in Flash, just drag a component into your movie, one or two lines of script, and you can have a very significant interaction going to a bend sensor and a bulb in another place. Let me move on. So I have a couple other videos to show you quick. So step back for 1 second. This is a video of one of the first more explorative courses we did. It wasn't thinking about such human need-centered stuff as much as see what students could really do with keyboards. Here's some examples of just keyboards, and then I'll show what they can do with analog. So again, this is just the switch project leading into this particular semester. But using just springs and wire, students are able to track position in a room. They start using even copper tape and building things in thermal formers because they have those technologies. They can cast plastics and rubbers. So you see, he went and got a Stairmaster out of the garbage when college ended one semester, and you pedal it until you, and it grows a model of a city until you're too tired and you rest your wrists on the handlebars and that heart rate monitor starts driving the animation while you're resting, and then you go back to pedaling. This one, tracing your steps, these projects, this assignment was how do you create an unmediated experience with nature, or how do you develop a metaphor for one. And so these were just people have influences on their environment, whether they know it or not, kind of thing. This one, two keyboards, two computers, cameras. As you push on these beach balls, it opens up a video around the beach ball of what's on the other side of the wall. And so it's a pretty sophisticated thing to build in 2 weeks for a student who's never programmed and never had any electrical experience, and with $0 worth of materials. You can see here they're little blocks of wood with pieces of copper plate glued to either side, and when you push the ball, it goes over and hits another piece of wire and opens up that video with just a simple Flash script. So really inventive solutions because the palette is so lo-fi. This is a little bit of what our studio looks like. These switches are just foam sponges in between two pieces of tin-plated steel, and that's what made that whole floor tracking system work. And then finally, this is using this application called NADA. Again, it's just a XML socket server that communicates between all these hardware widgets and Java and ActionScript APIs. And last year I was fortunate enough to be able to go and teach a course in Sweden for a semester, and these students did a one-week project in 5 days, no electrical experience, not even Flash experience before, never mind any programming. This really ugly intro that intern did. So.
And wrist extension to prevent unnecessary muscular tension. Mm-hmm. So what is this cue? This thing that tells you to get up and...
The assignment is to think about repetitive stress disorders and how can we make interfaces for computers where people don't get carpal tunnel syndrome and stuff, but to be playful about it, as you'll see.
Exercise. Putting an animation of this little guy working, and whenever you have this situation, it starts going, it starts smoking, mm-hmm. smoke coming out of your head or something mm-hmm. like that.
Turning red or
turning red or whatever, some kind of alarm.
A single idea.
No, Mickey Mouse.
That's great. I've always loved you.
It will be like, if you have the circle here, for instance, we have some rubber here and some rubber here, it will be cool.
So, if I push here, then...
We have the idea, but we don't have the hardware yet, so we can test it.
Okay.
We're now measuring up the movement of this arm.
I'm writing the action script for the rest of the hand, for the movement of the wrist.
Okay.
So I hope in 10 minutes it's going to be working.
Cool. Fine. Like that.
Number one. Did you see number one? That's two. Here's one.
Wow. Hold it up. Hi. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's so nice. Okay, show it to the camera. Can you hold that up for the camera?
We've used NADA action script, we've used these flexible sensors in this part to measure the movement of the fingers in relation to the hand, and this flexible sensor here to describe the movement of the wrist. It's attached to the line.
I like the sound.
And notice, as I was telling, there's just one single frame here, and the action script elements are not much different on this for each case.
So for that entire hand demo, this tracking of five fingers and height and bending of the wrist, this is all the scripting. And so you can see, I hope that's proof enough of the way that the ways we've come since just developing this wooden model of what looks like a product that we may want people to try, but we can only hand it to them and ask them to imagine how it would work, what its behavior is like, to now in a couple of days an industrial designer being able to build a more higher fidelity model. So if there's a tie-in to hacking here, I think it's the resourcefulness. I think the great quote last night from the Shmoo group was, break stuff to make stuff that doesn't break. And so I think we've followed in that kind of philosophy, and I think that's about it for me. If there's some questions, I think I've got about another 5 minutes. I can answer some in here, or if people'd like to talk more about the kits or anything like that, we'll be just out here. Can also, if you're interested, go to sketchtools.com, where there'll be more information about the application. One of the trickiest things for us now as a design consultancy and teachers is, what do we do with this thing? How do we allow developers to participate, but how do we also fund its further development? And there's been a lot of discussion about this in this community for a long time. We're really interested in that debate. And for right now, we're going to release it as inexpensively as we possibly can and continue developing it, while also sponsoring projects and giving applications away to schools that can't afford it to start with. So are there any questions? Yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm kind of getting at without saying that. So is there a possibility of releasing NADA as open source? Yeah, we've been on the fence about this for a long time, and I've been to quite a few conferences and discussions about open source for a number of years now, and was actually just with one of the guys from Wikipedia at the Doors of Perception conference, and we talked about this for a while, and we don't really have a model right now that we can envision of selling support or selling advertising or something like this that are kind of normal ways to fund an open source project. Really, we're a design consultancy, and we originally built this tool so that we could design better stuff ourselves. This isn't our end product. Our end product is medical devices for, you know, we're doing a thing that microwaves your prostate, you know, and so we need to be able to mark up, you know, the handheld component, the touchscreen component, the pathways that the doctor walks from patient to screen to object, what's sterile, what's not sterile, all those things. This is just a tool set for us. We wanted it to be as transparent as possible. We are just really getting our sea legs in the whole business of selling a product. What does it mean to offer a responsible level of support to people? So far, our deal is make it cheap, like $100 cheap. In the realm of flash and stuff like that, it's relatively inexpensive considering what it allows you to do. That could change over time. But then, you know, a guy comes up to me last week at Microsoft, and he's from Nokia, and says, I want to use this in our labs to develop phones. Is it $100? So these are hard questions. I don't think any of us are really selfish, and we have a lot of appreciation for the benefits that come from a developer-supported application. And we're trying to make the edges of this router application as open as possible, like developing your own extensions for hardware as we can support that. But again, what are we going to do? Just keep paying for this and paying for the developer hours in our office until we can't do it anymore? Or if anyone has any suggestions or knowledge about this stuff, I'm very open to discussing that. Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. I think that's really, I can't say that we've changed the world, but that's really all we're doing. All the studio projects that I'm doing, the one that I've done for the last 18 months, unfortunately, I'm not allowed to publish or talk about extensively until at least in another 6 months, but what I can say is it was with Mass General Hospital and actually the Department of Defense to work on a training simulator for combat medics, which, you know, you can't meet a group of people more opposed to war than, you know, an art school in New England. But, and believe me, I mean, even the 15 students that committed to this project got razzed by everybody. But we worked on that sort of thing all the way to education and support for disaster victims and for refugees. I could show you a lot of projects like that. I just made a presentation at Doors of Perception this year just about humanitarian applications for technology and design. And so I think it's a great question. In the fall, I'm doing a course between Brown and RISD that's just looking at the transfer of care from point of injury to, you know, first responder fireman to EMT to paramedic to emergency department, and the downstream flow of physical patient, single-use products, data of the patient care record, and how can we make that better. So these are always the topics. The topics are what I hope you take away. I guess one of the big things is our topic isn't technology. We're obviously not doing something massively impressive to people with ear chops technologically. What we're doing is trying to make technology accessible to the people who really have a strong influence on the products that end up in our world, have a massive impact on the environment, massive impact on people who have special needs, and so many other audiences down to us who do have teeth. You know. Are there any more questions? I really should, I think, get out of the way for our next speakers, but I appreciate your time and hope it was interesting. Thank you.